Sleep apnea, domestic violence, and paediatric emergencies, three major health topics all in one show. Welcome to this week's highlight show. Today we're going to discuss some scary situations in which parents could suddenly find themselves. But first, we'll review two of our previous episodes in a fast, succinct way. And on top of that, stay with us as we highlight important ideas and solutions for a healthier lifestyle. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. I'm Dr. Nerida and I'm pleased you've joined me today. Go Healthy for Good is live every Monday to Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Go Healthy Live and check out our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. Sleep apnea is very common and in fact it's estimated that 1 in 4 adults are at high risk for obstructive sleep apnea where the airway blocks during deep sleep. Risk factors include obesity, abnormalities of the upper airway and enlarged tonsils or adenoids. Apart from preventing deep sleep, it also contributes to hypertension, coronary artery disease, cardiac arrhythmias and heart failure. Let's join Dr. Golam Motamedi, Associate Professor of Neurology at Georgetown University School of Medicine, and Dr. Rod Willey, a member of the American Dental Association and a diplomat of the Academy of Clinical Sleep Disorders Dentistry, as they discuss sleep apnea. Watch this. Dr. Motamedi, what is sleep apnea? Can you explain that to us and how it's diagnosed?
Yep. Sleep apnea happens when during sleep, instead of normally breathing, which is normally controlled by our autonomic system, we stop breathing. And that it means actually the drive, the central drive for breathing continues, as we see during sleep study. Chest and abdomen keep moving. But because of a closure of the upper airway.
I think we've got a graphic of this too while you're talking. You might just talk it through that. But yes,
sure. Normally, our upper airway or the area around the pharynx and larynx has a musculature that keep the tone. Mm-hmm. Because when we breathe, we create a negative pressure or vacuum, if you will, in that area. So when we breathe, that musculature tone keeps the upper airway open. But what happens during sleep is we lose muscle tone. And that is actually a requirement for sleep. As the muscle tone is gone during sleep, especially during slower stages of sleep or REM sleep, then the falling of the tongue, it falls backward, loss of tone in the other musculature in the area results in narrowing or complete shutdown of the upper airway. As a result, while the patient is trying to breathe and all the effort is there, there is no passage there for air to go to the lung. And as a result, there is a buildup of CO2 in the brain. And after a while, like 10, 20, 30, sometimes 40 seconds, patient wakes up gasping for air to compensate for that and fall asleep. And this cycle repeats itself over and over.
Mm. Sounds so unpleasant. How common is it, Rod? How many people?
Very common. In fact, there's some estimates out there showing that there's approximately 18 million that have obstructive sleep apnea in the United States alone, with 90% going undiagnosed.
90%.
So the amazing thing is it goes under the radar. I mean, we look at people and we say, okay, well, we got high blood pressure, can't get to sleep, getting up too much, using the restroom, and daytime fatigue, and so we're getting, and we put medications on all these, and all too many times, never really considering the possibility that maybe it could be a very serious condition called obstructive sleep apnea.
Dr. Motamedi, I believe you have a polysomnograph here for us to look at to just see what a sleep study looks like in someone who has sleep apnea. We see here on this graph that the breathing just stops completely. Is that what we're seeing?
Exactly. Where you see a flat line while the other ones show activity, those that show activity are reflecting the activity by chest and abdomen, means diaphragm and other musculature that are working, because the brain is sending the signal that breathe. But because of the closure of the upper airway, you see that flattening of the airflow, which means practically the patient is not breathing during that period. And that may repeat itself, as you mentioned earlier, 100 times. Or there are patients who practically are not breathing during sleep. Because we don't count less than 10 seconds. When we say apnea, we are talking about at least 10 seconds. And there are people who may stop breathing for even 40 seconds or longer. So practically, you are not breathing for a good chunk of your night's sleep. And as a result, there is increase in CO2, there is change in the what we call sympathetic tone, and there is a lack of that refreshing, restorative sleep. So in the morning, patients are tired. What's usually called excessive daytime sleepiness, and also change in mood. They may look grumpy. Usually that's the complaint with the spouse. And they have memory problem. So a sleep study will show these findings. Also, it will take a look at the structure of the sleep if they go into deep stages of sleep. Normally, you should spend about 25% of the sleep. A typical sleep apnea patient spends zero. They never enter the deep stages of sleep. Because of that continuous disruption in sleep. Or REM sleep, which is a period when we have dreams, and it plays a role in memory consolidation. That is gone.
Now, Dr. Motamedi, one of the common things to use for treatment is CPAP. Can you explain to our viewers what CPAP is and how it works?
Sure. CPAP stands for continuous positive air pressure. Basically, what it does, by pushing the air through the upper airway, it creates a pneumatic splint. It's a non-pharmacological treatment. It's a very nice and still a first-line therapy. What it does by opening up the upper airway during inhalation, it lets people breathe, so opens up that closure in the upper airway. The downside is that, unfortunately, about half of patients may not tolerate it. Mm-hmm. And if the patient has severe sleep apnea and they don't respond to CPAP, then we will look into other possibilities.
Now, Dr. Rod, what is an alternative to CPAP or maybe used in conjunction with CPAP that you're using?
Well, the oral sleep appliance is the mandibular repositioning appliance.
We have a graphic here.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, and feel free to just talk through this.
And the appliance itself, it works as mechanically holding the airway open. So when you go into the deep sleep, your jaw begins to fall back. Your tongue is connected to it. It falls back with it, blocking the airway out, starting the obstructive sleep apnea. The appliance holds the airway open by keeping the jaw forward and doing the adjustments along the way that is there. So when you're looking at the animation of this, and you can see how the actual structure of the anatomy and how it's blocked out, just simply keeping that jaw forward can help to reduce that. The appliances were originally developed in the early 90s. And it went through 15 years of scrutiny and testing and research and all the stuff that has to go. Mm. And in 2006, it received its nod of approval from the FDA, as well as the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, the branch in medicine that the neurologists and the sleep specialists from the medical standpoint all belong to.
Right.
They did the research on this, and their official word that they came out with is that it is very effective in the mild to moderate for treatment of obstructive sleep apnea as a treatment for it. And it can also be used as an alternative to the CPAP for severe sleep apnea for those who are not able to use the CPAP. It only works to a point. If it's super severe, then it will not do it. You can usually get about a 3 times reduction in the amount of times of slowed or stopped breathing. So it's effective, sometimes partially effective, if it's too severe. And then what's really cool, and we were just talking about this, is the combined therapy where we would, if it is too severe and we have a patient that cannot do the CPAP, they're not able to tolerate it, then we would place an appliance, reduce it down as much as possible with just the appliance, getting it adjusted to the correct level. Once we find that position, then we would reintroduce a minimally invasive CPAP, maybe just something that just goes in the nose instead of the full mouth.
Right, just the nasal pillows.
Right, just the nasal pillows, and at a reduced pressure to augment the appliance, allowing the appliance to be the workhorse, and it's something then that the patient can live with and get the best of both worlds. Because really what we're all about is getting something that can be successful in treating the patient.
If you have obstructive sleep apnea or think you're at risk, then please address the issue. See your doctor and ask for a full assessment. There are several options for treatment of this serious disorder, including surgery, CPAP, and the oral device. In addition, you should stop smoking, don't use alcohol as a sleep aid, lose weight, and be sure to pursue the treatment that's most effective for you. Often it takes some perseverance, but in the long run, your heart is going to thank you for it. In just a moment, we'll show the highlights of the domestic violence show. Don't miss it. We'll be back after a short break.
All around the world, Seventh-day Adventists are reading one chapter of the Bible per day. We call it Revived by His Word. Please join in and visit the Revived by His Word website. Open today's reading and read the accompanying blog. Add your comments or read the comments of others. Get the Google Calendar to remind you, or download the printable calendar of the reading program. Learn more about Revived by His Word and how you can tell others about this project.
Be in an abusive relationship if your partner calls you names, continually criticizes you, punishes you by withholding affection, expects you to ask permission, threatens to hurt you, humiliates you, scares you by driving recklessly, traps you in your own home, or monitors where you go and who you spend time with. Domestic violence can cause hypertension, asthma, post-traumatic stress disorder, irritable bowel syndrome, arthritis, hypertension, and heart disease. And then there is the impact on children. Boys exposed to domestic violence are twice as likely to become perpetrators as adults. Let's take a look at the valuable information Professor Tricia Bent-Goodley, a social worker with a doctorate in social policy, along with Jennifer Hill, Executive Director of the Domestic Violence Centre of Howard County, Maryland, shares with us. Watch closely. When we think of victims, we almost always think of women, but can men be victims as well?
Absolutely. There are men who are victims of domestic violence. We do know that the majority of victims, survivors of domestic violence, in fact, between 85 to 95% are actually women.
But there are men.
But there are men who experience domestic violence in a smaller proportion. Certainly, we need to be equally as concerned. It's critical that we are for men and women. However, we do know that for the most part, it's women who are experiencing domestic violence.
Now, Jennifer, domestic violence is a very broad term. How is it manifested? How might we define it?
Sure. Domestic violence is going to be a whole range of types of abuses that someone might endure. I think, typically think of it as physical violence. That's what we see on TV shows and in the movies and what seems to be the most visual that people recognize. And certainly that does occur, but not always. We also consider emotional and psychological abuse. Someone who might tell you that you're terrible or that you're not worth anything or that you don't deserve to be healthy and happy, that kind of emotional, psychological abuse we consider to be part of the larger types of domestic violence behaviors. Things like economic abuse, having sole control over the funding, not allowing you to have access. Sometimes we've heard of abusers that give out allowances to their spouse or partner, controlling all the credit cards, isolating someone so that they don't have connections to family or friends or any sort of outside folks. Sometimes folks will restrict their victims from working or going to school as a means to further isolate them. all of those kinds of behaviors are things that we would consider to be domestic violence because someone is exerting power or control over somebody else's life, and that can have lots of different faces.
So it can be quite subtle.
Absolutely.
But if a couple are dating, Tricia, are there any telltale signs that she might have been able to see, or anyone out there might see, that they are actually dating a perpetrator?
Well, there's some signs that I think are important to look for. So, for example, if this is a person who's really possessive, they're very controlling, they appear to be jealous, quite often. Those are some signs that, you know, this person might actually or could be a perpetrator of abuse. The other thing that we also want to say is that if the person has perpetrated abuse before, that's definitely a sign. Sometimes we find that a person might say, well, that would never happen to me. Or maybe it happened to that person, but I'm different. And so if you find out that the person that you're dating has been in an abusive relationship before and they've abused someone else, that's a really critical sign. And it's something for you to really think about. And I would say, I would say it would not be a good relationship to enter into. And so it's important for us to just be able to see some of those signs. So previous abuse, being jealous, overly possessive, someone who isolates you or tells you what you should do, where you should go, what you should wear. Those are all really important signs for us.
So those are warning signs to say, ooh, start to back out. What are the risk factors, Jennifer, for domestic violence? Within a home or within a perpetrator's life, what might be the risk factors for that situation?
Well, sometimes we will do what's called a lethality assessment with folks that are in contact with us because they're concerned about a domestic violence relationship. A lethality assessment really looks at the situation that someone's describing to see how dangerous it might be. Of course, domestic violence is always a terrible thing. Some of it may be more physically dangerous than others. And so some of the things that might cause someone to be high on that risk factor in terms of lethality would be if the perpetrator has lost their job recently, if there are guns or other weapons in the home, if there are children in the home that's not the perpetrator's children. Those are some of the things that might indicate that a domestic violence relationship may be a higher risk for severe kinds of violence as opposed to general sorts of violence.
When a couple get married, it might seem all sweet and kind, and a little bit of abuse might happen, but it's forgiven. And so it can be subtle to some women that they just feel like, and often, you know, it takes two to tango, and we do provoke each other sometimes in our relationships, and so they often think that's what I deserved. So what can you say to women who may be out there watching the show about how they should think about that?
Sure. Well, first I want to say we often see what we call the cycle of violence in a relationship. So we might have something that starts off very sweet and kind and very tender. We actually call it the honeymoon phase, where things are what you would expect from a happy new relationship. And then it will sometimes move into what we call a tension-building phase, in which there might be more arguments. People might describe that phase as walking on eggshells, that you think the other person might kind of lose it, but you're not sure exactly what to expect. And that will then erupt into what we call a battering phase or an abusive phase, in which the abuse is a little more pronounced. And then that gets followed up by a honeymoon phase, where the abuser may be very apologetic and say that this will never happen again and they're sorry they lost control. And when you love a person and when you've committed yourself to a person, you really want to believe that that's true. You want to believe that they can change their behavior, that maybe they're having other stressors in their life that they're not knowing how to handle. And if they can figure out how to handle those stressors, this isn't going to happen again. And so it's not uncommon that victims look to blame themselves because they feel like if they can change their behavior, they can prevent this from happening. But the reality is it's not their behavior that's causing this violence. It's the perpetrator's behavior. It's their responsibility to change their behavior.
And that violence, there should be no toleration.
Absolutely
of violence.
Not.
Absolutely not.
Now, Tricia, what should we do if we see a situation of domestic violence happening? Let's say we're a neighbor, we can hear it, or maybe we're actually in that situation ourselves. What should we do?
So if you're a neighbor, you can hear it, or if you're driving down the street and you witness it, you know, and this does happen, first of all, you want to make sure that you're safe. So you want to make sure that you adhere to your own safety. But I would definitely say call 911. Call a police officer if you hear something that could be going on in your neighbor's house. If you have a friend who might be experiencing abuse, what I would say is you want to be there for them as best as you can be there for them. You want to support them. But the top thing that I would say is that if you are aware of a situation and someone's experiencing domestic violence, or if you are in a domestic violence situation, one of the things that we know is that women are at their greatest risk when they decide to leave the situation. And so we often ask, why does this person stay in this relationship? Why don't they just leave? Well, we know that the danger is at its highest point, at the point at which the person has decided to leave the relationship. So what I always say is that don't do it alone. Don't do it alone. Make sure that you reach out to someone who can help you. If you don't know someone in your local community, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE. 1-800-799-SAFE, and make sure that you get support so that you can transition, get a safety plan, and get out of that relationship in a safe way.
Do you feel safe in your own home? If not, you may be a victim of domestic violence. Be assured, though, you are not alone. Don't be embarrassed. There are people around you who understand and want to help. They will support you in finding safety for you and any children that may be involved. Domestic violence agencies are there to help. Call the hotline 1-800-799-SAFE. If you're suffering the after effects of abuse, I want to encourage you with this promise from Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Coming up next, we'll make cookies that the kids will love. But first, let's take a look at this week's medical news report. A study was done in Istanbul, Turkey, in patients with obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, to assess the long-term effectiveness of the surgical procedure submucosal uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, or UPPP for short. The respiratory distress index dropped by over 50% in almost half the patients. Snoring disappeared in 83% of them, and excess daytime sleepiness decreased in 68%. Postoperative body mass index increased during follow-up period, which lasted 3 to 8 years. Those who did not respond to surgery gained the most weight. It would appear that a UPPP can reduce symptoms, but is limited in its ability to treat OSA. Post-op weight gain decreases its success even further. So if you've had a UPPP, be sure to keep your weight down. In a Swedish study, 90 patients with OSA were fitted with a mandula reperfusioning appliance to evaluate the effects of this treatment. 48 completed the study. There was a clear trend towards less apnea, less oxygen desaturation, less daytime sleepiness, and less snoring. So, a dental device may be an important part of your treatment. One of the most consistent findings to emerge from research on domestic or intimate partner violence, or IPV for short, is that it tends to run in the family. The US National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, or AD Health for short, analyzed intergenerational transmission of IPV. Genetic factors accounted for up to 50% of the violence.
pointing out the importance of genetic factors in the causation of IPV. However, it should be remembered that the other 50% is environmental and therefore should be preventable. With the increasing knowledge of epigenetics and brain mapping, I suspect that even less than 50% may be related to genetics. Child abuse is a major social problem, and many children are not identified by healthcare professionals. A new hospital-based policy was developed in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, to identify at-risk children. All adults presenting to the emergency department for domestic violence, substance abuse, or attempted suicide are asked if they have any children in their care. If they do, they're urged to visit the pediatric clinic with their children. If they attend, problems are evaluated and voluntary referrals arranged to various care organisations. If they refuse, their children are reported to the Dutch Child Abuse Counselling and Reporting Centre. Analysis after 2 years shows that the policy is making a difference for children at risk of domestic violence. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Medical News Report.
The Bible has so much practical counsel about the Christian life, what it means to be a good steward of the resources that God has entrusted in our care, how to have healthy marriage relationships or relationships with our children, relationships with people around us. The Christian life, that's our topic this week on Hope Sabbath School.
The Lord reigns forever. He has established His throne for judgment. He rules the world in righteousness and judges the people with equity. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Those who know Your name trust in You, for You, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek You.
Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. Now, I have two special guests in the kitchen with me today. I have Isabella and DeMarco. Isabella, what are we making today? We're making some cookies, right?
Yes.
Oatmeal and banana cookies. Tell our viewers what we're going to put in our cookies then.
1/3 cup unsweetened peanut butter, 2 overripe bananas, 1 teaspoon vanilla essence, 2 tablespoons soy milk, 2 tablespoons agave, 2.5 cups quick oats, and 1/4 cup of oat flour.
Okay, so it's great having all these helpers in the kitchen with me. Why don't, DeMarco, you like bananas?
Yes.
You do. Well, then you'll know how to peel a banana. Do you want to start mashing your banana in there? There
yes.
You go. You peel that. And Isabella, why don't we start mixing the dry ingredients? Let's
okay.
put the oats in your bowl. We got quick oats and oat flour.
This one, right?
Very good. You can just drop it in there. Great. Okay, you want to start mashing that up? And you're already done. Mix it up nicely so that all the dry ingredients go through. Mix it. Nice. So it's all mixed around. That's good. Keep mixing it. And how's that mashing going? We're doing all right? I think we need to use our muscles. Come on, boys have big muscles, don't they? Let's see. Oh, yeah. Oh, those are big muscles. I can feel them. Nice. Now we're going to put some peanut butter in with the banana. Yum. Do you like having peanut butter on your bananas?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you, DeMarco?
Yes.
Oh. Well then, we're all going to like this. You want to scrape that off for me? That's it. Very good. And then we'll put the rest of the goodies in there. You want to mix them up well? Here you go. You use that if you like. There's some milk. You like agave? Agave nectar,
mm-hmm.
You do? Yeah, it's one of my favorite sweeteners. It's just yummy. What do you eat your agave on?
I like mine on pancakes.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes.
What else do you like it on?
I guess just pancakes.
Just pancakes?
Yes.
Oh.
Now I'm gonna
so on my pancakes, I put some almond butter, and then I slice some banana, and then I pour over a little of the agave. Ah, and then I'll put some yogurt. I call it whipped cream, though, because it just looks so beautiful. What do you put on yours?
I put the agave, and sometimes I put blueberries on my pancakes.
Oh, yum, blueberries. We did blueberries the other night. Cool. Now, that looks really good, DeMarco. What say we add this to Isabella's bowl of dry ingredients now? There we go. Now you've got a job to mix that through, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Let's see this.
But I know you can do it. We're going to end up with some yummy cookies. Do you help Mum make cookies sometimes, you guys?
You usually help her make brownies.
Yeah. Brownies. Yeah? What are your favorite cookies, DeMarco?
Probably just normal chocolate.
Normal chocolate cookies or chocolate chip cookies?
Chocolate chip cookies.
Chocolate chip cookies. Well, these are going to be really healthy cookies. Do you want to swap to this one? Is this one going to be better for you?
I think so.
You think? I might put a little welly in here. Hang on a minute. Let's see. It's kind of dry. Let me chop that up a little bit for you.
Thank you.
See if that will help. You know, the more we mash the banana, and we can even like almost cream it, the more moisture that can come out of it. So we want to get that banana really nicely mashed up. So it's really thin. Oh. Coming, isn't it?
Yep. Looks good.
Does look good. When I was your age, I used to make lots and lots of cookies made with quick oats. They're almost my favorite. So now if I can't make them, I like to get granola bars. Do you like granola bars?
Yes. I like the raisin granola bars.
You like raisin granola ones. Which granola bars do you like? Or do you like them, DeMarco?
Yes.
You do too. Oh, look at that. That did finally come together. That took some stirring, didn't it?
Now it looks yummy.
It does look yummy. Put that there. All right. Do you want to bring it down the table and put it just here? There we go. Great. Now, I'll come through here. We're going to spray this. And then you can start making little... Ooh. Now, do you want to put some on there? You can go like this. I'll show you. Here you go. And then you turn it over and tip it out by squeezing. Upside down. That's it. Good. We'll flip that over. There. Do you want to do one, DeMarco? Let's see. I'll fill it up for you. You've got to push it on the side like that. Okay. So then you turn it over and squeeze it. And then they end up all the same size. Oh, perfect. Well, I think I think you kids did a great job. Thanks for coming on Go Healthy today. Do you know this is the best time in the show you came for? Because we get to eat the cookies that we made earlier. Okay, choose your cookie. One of these ones. They've been baked in the oven. We've baked them at 350 degrees for about 15 minutes. What do you think? Are they good? Should I taste them?
They're really good.
They're delicious.
Oh, really? Ah. Mmm. You're right. They are yummy. Mmm. I love that banana taste. Well, in just a minute, I'm going to answer some questions that you've sent me through Facebook and text messaging. I really like your questions, so please keep them coming. But first, here's another Ageless Advantage spot. Enjoy.
Is it a big deal if you are a couch potato? Well, a recent study by the National Institutes of Health argues that physical inactivity and obesity are very big deals. Obesity and physical inactivity increase your risk for a lot of unpleasant things, specifically heart disease, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and certain cancers. And these risks increase as we get older. So today, get up off the couch and enjoy some physical activity, which is another ageless advantage.
Welcome back. If you missed a previous episode or want to download one of our recipes, then visit our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. We're also on iTunes. Just look for our video podcasts there. Thanks for posting your comments and questions on Facebook. And here are some that we have not had a chance to answer up till now. Marion posted on Facebook, "My daughter and I really have enjoyed your program." Thanks, Marion. And Mary asks, "I've been a vegetarian all my life. I'm now 45. Should I take vitamin B12 since I don't eat meat?" Marion, what I would say is if you're total vegetarian with no animal products at all, then yes, you should replace vitamin B12. We do have stores that will last between 3 and 8 years, but then our stores of vitamin B12 will run out, and there are quite serious consequences to that. So you would want to have at least 5 micrograms a day. Now, most tablets come in 500 or 1,000 micrograms, so it will definitely fit the bill. And you could have them just once a week. That's what I do. I just take mine one day at the weekends. I take my vitamin B12 tablet because I'm almost totally vegetarian. Now, if you have dairy or eggs, you may get enough. It's worth, though, having a blood test to check if you have enough vitamin B12. If your levels are good, then you're fine. You might want to, though, keep an eye on that and just see if you're sustaining them. So get 2 readings. If it's falling, you want to be supplementing. But when you supplement, you just chew the tablet and you'll absorb it fine, usually, if it's because of a dietary deficiency. Danny asked, "I would like to lose weight, therefore I've started drinking diet sodas. Will diet sodas help me lose weight when compared to regular sodas?" Danny, unfortunately not. You know, when we're born, the sweetest thing we know is milk. And then we get introduced to a banana and we think, now that's sweet. And then we go to our first birthday party and we taste sugar and chocolate and all those things. And we think, forget the banana. Definitely forget the milk. I want sugar, right? Artificial sweeteners are even sweeter and they drive your taste buds. Usually with sweetness, we also have fat. And so it's been found that people who use artificial sweeteners are more likely to gain weight than those that simply use sugar. It's better to just be healthy and eat a healthy diet. Now, Lisa posted on Facebook, "Are mushrooms good for your health?" Great question, Lisa. And so I've always pondered that because I think, well, should I really be eating fungus? And, you know, mushrooms are good. They've got protein, they've got fiber, B vitamins, they've got some minerals like phosphorus, copper, and selenium. So, and many mushrooms, not the regular mushrooms that we buy in our supermarkets, but there are a number of mushrooms that produce anti-cancer agents. And so they're often used in herbal remedies. Good question. Thanks for sending them. Keep them coming. Now, if you have any health-related questions, post them on our Facebook page, please, or call us, 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. When we come back, an ER physician will join us live in the studio to share important information on poisoning and closed head injuries. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
As for me, I call to God and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon I cry out in distress, and He hears my voice.
Welcome back. Joining me right now is Dr. Gabriel David, an ER physician from Kettering Medical Center, Dayton, Ohio. Welcome, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great. Now, you know, you work in ER, and so you see a lot of children.
I do.
Children, they are so curious, and then they're also very good at putting things in their mouth.
Sure.
So we're going to start our discussion today talking about poisonings. What should a parent do if they perhaps come into a room and they see a bottle open or something missing and they suspect poisoning? What's the first thing they should do?
The first thing that they should do is see if the child is, you know, alert and talking to them. One of the most common things is when children ingest substances is worried about aspirating or choking on the substance. So make sure they're alert. Okay. The other thing is to find out what substance they ingested.
Mm. Let's take a look at what to do in a case of poisoning. Watch this video.
Daddy, can I have some lemonade?
Yeah, in a minute, sweetheart. I'm just going to fetch my brushes to clean. You know, right, little monkey? Gusty, what is it? What did you drink? What did you drink, sweetheart? Was it this? Was it this stuff here? Was it this? How much did you drink? Because Daddy doesn't know, because it was, I don't know what it was in the bottle before. Was it about that much? Yeah? Yeah? Okay.
My lips are
I know, sweetheart. Come here, come here, come here, give me a hug.
Good girl, good girl.
Hello, ambulance, please. My daughter, she's drunk something about 5 minutes ago. It's stuff you used to block drains. It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. It's about 50 mils.
Now, when you're in that situation, that child comes into ER, it's good for the parent to have brought the substance with them?
That's an excellent excellent suggestion. You know, bringing the substance adds additional data and information for, you know, the clinical staff or physicians to be able to identify the substance and to treat and find the antidote for the substance. Obviously. Right. You know, like the video detailed was, you know, you want to know what exactly the substance was when they approximately ingested the substance and how much.
So the time, how much, and what it is.
Exactly.
If you don't know, like an unlabeled bottle like that.
Sure.
Then, now she's drunk something that's caustic.
Sure.
How might you treat something like that, a bleach or a drain unblocker, what would you do? Because it's clearly it's causing mucosal damage in the mouth and presumably in the esophagus
sure.
as well.
And this is a kind of a frightening situation, and it is sadly common in a lot of in a lot of households today. Primarily, we would initially assess the patient's vital signs, so their heart rate, their the blood pressure, the oxygen saturation, make sure their airways is patent. If needed, they may need a breathing tube to help the child breathe.
And because that caustic material has gone right past the top of the ear.
Exactly.
Gone through, well, I guess our mouth and our pharynx is our airway.
Exactly. In the past, in the 1950s, there was a substance called syrup Ipecac that was kind of pushed for, ingestions, accidental ingestions for kids. And they discontinue and their recommendations are not recommended today because it induces vomiting. And by inducing vomiting, it can cause more of that caustic substance to kind of destroy the lining.
You do a rerun right through the
exactly,
same,
exactly,
the same
exactly.
And I guess you're adding stomach acid to it, which...
That's true. It's not helpful.
No, not at that point. No. What about medications? Let's say they've swallowed pills. What happens then?
Yeah, going back to assessing exactly what the child, when you bring in your child into the emergency department, one thing I would recommend is to call the Poison Control Center. there's in the U.S. there's a national poison control center, and it's a toll-free number. It's 1-800-222-122. Very easy number to remember. You can stick it on the fridge, stick it in the bathroom mirror, help remember that number. Primarily, I would call them first. Most substances in the household are generally safe, relatively safe, but there are substances that are harmful for the child, and that needs to be recorded and documented and further investigated as the patient comes in.
Mm. Now, we always need reminders about poison prevention.
Sure.
So what tips can you give parents or grandparents and even extended family? You know, you never know when you're going to have a child come to your home, and often the home that doesn't normally have children is the most unsafe, sure. I would suspect. But what can you what can you advise them about?
Sure.
Prevention of poisoning.
Yeah, I mean, every patient that I encounter that has, you know, an incidence of poisoning, I you know, reassure the parents and educate them and counsel them about, you know, providing additional preventive actions in the home, such as, you know, locks for the cabinets, making sure that bottles that are more caustic are at higher levels for the kids aren't able to reach it, you know.
So keep out of reach rather than relying on a lock that you might forget to relock.
Exactly.
So just keep them high. And any other tips? I guess medications and things.
Sure, yeah. Make sure medications are in a locked area where kids aren't able to reach. Also to know exactly how much medications are in there and what kind of medications are there. So you know exactly if how much the kid ingested, if that were the case.
Mm. So. Yeah, that's a good idea to know how much should be there.
Exactly.
Because if you've got teenagers, I mean, we've talked about teen drug abuse.
Sure.
You've got teenagers, they may be just abusing those drugs, and then little children can accidentally ingest. So that's a really good tip. Well, when we come back, we'll be talking about closed head injuries. Don't miss it. We'll be right back.
When temptations assail you, when care, perplexity, and darkness seem to surround your soul, look to the place where you last saw the light. Rest in Christ's love and under His protecting care. When sin struggles for the mastery in the heart, when guilt oppresses the soul and burdens the conscience, when unbelief clouds the mind, remember that Christ's grace is sufficient to subdue sin and banish the darkness. Entering into communion with the Savior, we enter the region of peace.
I know I'm looking for something, but what? Peace? Purpose? Meaning? I'm still not sure. But I know it's going to take faith.
When I read through The Great Hope, I came across a comment that gave me great hope. The comment is from Tyndale to the papacy, and this is what he says. Do you know who taught the eagles to find their prey? Well, that same God teaches His hungry children to find their Father in His Word. And I thought, isn't that the truth? The reformers, from studying Scripture, got the strength and the courage that they needed to face all the trials, tribulation, and persecution that came their way. And for me, that is a great hope, because in studying the Word of God, I can get to know my Father, and I can also have the strength and courage to face the trials that come down the road in my life.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Dr. David Gabriel, who is an ER physician. Dr. David,
yes.
You know, children, they're very active.
Sure.
They're fearless. They do things that we can't believe that they would actually attempt, but they do it because I guess they don't know the consequences. And yet at the same time, they're learning coordination, and they're kind of a different proportion to an adult. They have a large head, small face, and a relatively small body. So they tend to be a little top heavy. And so head injuries are so common amongst children, are they not?
That's so true. There's over 500,000 yearly that come and visit the ER for a closed head injury, aka traumatic brain injury or concussion. Mm. Usually the age of distribution of that is bimodal. So initially, like you talked about, it's the 0 to 4 year olds are more prone to accidents and traumatic brain injury. And also it skips a couple of years and goes into the 15 to 19 year old range, or the adolescent range,
with
a little bit high risk taking behaviors.
Right, and sport, I guess. As
exactly.
Well.
Yeah, there's over 135,000 related sports-related, recreational-related traumatic brain injuries in our adolescents.
Wow.
That come into the emergency room department.
Hmm.
It's a fair high number of of sports-related injuries.
Right.
That we see.
Yeah, and head injuries, I guess, are the commonest thing that brings a child to an ER, and 90% of those, I believe, are head injuries. Trauma is the commonest, and then head injuries make up about 90% of them,
yes.
75 to 90%. Now, let's perhaps pose a scenario. Little Bonnie, she falls off, say, the jungle gym, and she lands on her head. Mum sees it. What should tell Mum whether or not to bring her to ER?
Yeah, that's a great question. Primarily, you want to check the patient's or the child's responsiveness to, her normal behavior. How is she reacting after the event? Obviously, there are going to be some crying, some pain after the event. But things we worry about: if they're vomiting, they have increased confusion, some short-term memory loss, also some headaches, change in vision. Usually at the younger age, less than 2, they recommend if there's a scalp laceration or a cut around the head, a large hematoma or a large bruise around the head, also that would be indication to be checked out in the emergency department.
All right, so large bruise, a laceration in the little ones, but any of those other signs? So that was vomiting, blurred vision, confusion. And if they lost consciousness with the fall, definitely.
Definitely would come in for loss of consciousness, syncope, change in a normal gait or movement.
So they can't walk a straight
exactly.
line, any of those things. So let's say you're in the ER when little Bonnie arrives. How do you assess her? What are you actually looking for? What are the signs that might concern you?
Sure. The one thing we look about when our patients are coming, especially with mild traumatic brain injury or concussions, is a multifactorial case. So we would look at the mechanism of how they fell. Was it?
So you want to know the story.
Exactly. So we want to find out, was it just standing on the floor and kind of tripped and fell, or was it, up in a ladder, a 10-foot ladder, and fall? That's one thing we investigate into. Also investigate on, how they responded after the event or after the fall, or whether they were responsive. Yeah, were they conscious? Were they acting appropriately? Were they vomiting? Did they have any signs of, nausea or headaches? Those are things we look for. There's a indicator. We also plug that into a clinical tool that we use, which is a Glasgow Coma Scale. It measures. Gives us a rating of eye, verbal, and motor responsiveness to our direction, and whether the score correlates to whether we need to do further investigation.
So they can follow commands, you look in their eyes, and all right. Now, what would prompt you to do more imaging, a CT or MRI? What sort of things would you be concerned
with? Sure, and that's a very common question that we get asked from parents, whether we need to do additional testing. Primarily, again, we go back to their history of how they fell.
So a loss of consciousness or anything else that would make you say, definitely we need to do imaging.
Exactly. So things we talked about initially was scalp laceration, large hematoma, you know, constantly having nausea and vomiting, severe headaches that are not controlled with routine pain medicines.
So most kids that have any of those symptoms, you would automatically just do
exactly,
the imaging.
Exactly.
Because it's a hard nut and you can't see what's going on.
Sure, exactly. You want to worry about life-threatening injuries from these events.
And then later on, after concussion, what do we need to worry about?
So primarily there's what we call the post-concussive syndrome, which is usually concussive symptoms such as the headache, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, irritability. They usually linger for about 7 to 10 days after a kind of a mild traumatic brain injury or a fall. Usually that's usually monitored.
So 7 to 10 days later you can get those symptoms.
You can still have those symptoms, yes.
Right.
Primarily after, if the patient is, you know, hemodynamically stable, or their blood pressure, heart rate are stable upon discharge, we want to educate the family members and the parents, you know, to have a reevaluation within 24 hours by their primary care physician, their sports physician, a neurologist, or some other physician.
All right, so stay closely involved with your family practitioner. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the review of this week's topics. Please remember, the choices you make each day will become habits. Make those habits good ones. The battle becomes easier. Now, Go Healthy for Good will take a break for 3 weeks during these upcoming days. We'll play the best of our first season, and we'll prepare some new features for our show for next year. On behalf of me and my team, I want to wish you a wonderful Christmas. At this special time of the year, may God bless you and your family with joy and peace. I'm going to be heading back to my home country of New Zealand, away from the cold winter here in North America. And on January 7, we'll start our 2013 season with some surprises for you. Remember, Go Healthy for Good is staying with you during the holiday season with our best shows. We'll start a brand new one January 7. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. Stay healthy, eat well, exercise regularly. We'll see you soon.